Alyssa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Well, the last time I got to chat with Senator Blumenthal, we knew that this upcoming hearing was going to happen with the PGA and potentially with LIV Golf. And we had two big officials with the PGA show up to Washington, D.C. And for a three-hour hearing, they basically kind of defended their actions and kept kind of reiterating, it seemed like, that the deal wasn't done just yet. So joining us, of course, is Senator Richard Blumenthal, who, by the way, is the subcommittee chairman and has been probably one of the loudest voices saying, wait a minute, I don't know if I really like this deal. Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Welcome back. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me back. Good to be with you.
So it seemed like the PGA showed up. LIV Golf, what, declined or just didn't show up?
Greg Norman of LIV Golf said he had scheduling conflicts. So did the head of the Public Investment Fund, which, as you recall, is the monarchy's sovereign wealth fund. It's an instrument of the Saudi government, and it's the one who is, in effect, taking over the PGA Tour on behalf of the Saudis. So we're working with them to find another date that's acceptable for another hearing. But the net result of the hearing we held a day or ago was to uncover a lot of facts. For example, Greg Norman is going to be out of a job at LIV Golf. And the agreement that they said is a draft is actually just an agreement to agree. It's not really specific in any of its terms. But what's clear is that the Saudis will have financial control over the PGA Tour, which includes the Travelers Championship in Cromwell with all of its economic impact on the surrounding area, $60 million worth, and $3 million of charitable contributions. There are a lot of high stakes here, and not the least of them is that this iconic American institution, the PGA Tour, has such widespread economic implications. But also, you know, it's an iconic, cherished American institution, and it's more than just the game of golf that's at stake. It's an attempt by a repressive autocratic government to sportswash, literally whitewash its image and try to distract or dispel attention from its murdering journalists, suppressing dissent, killing and torturing dissidents and women who are deprived of rights. And, of course, for us in Connecticut, very importantly, it's injustice to the 9/11 families who are seeking justice and its complicity in the 9/11 attack.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that Jay Monahan didn't show up. The commissioner.
He's been on medical leave with an undisclosed condition that has prevented him from coming to work.
Got it.
We don't know what it is, but he has said he's coming back in later this month. And we wanted to move ahead with the hearing because what we're doing here is uncovering facts. We're doing the investigation that will show what went into the deal, concluded in incredible secrecy, who was responsible, and most importantly, what it means for the future of the sport.
I mean, and so the reason I bring up Jay Monahan is sort of because of what you just ended your first statement with, Senator Blumenthal, which was this deal, this proposed deal, completely counteracts what Jay Monahan had said publicly. He said it on national television. You know, when he said, we could never support an organization that is tied to Saudi Arabia and the conflict that we have seen in the past, and including 9/11, obviously, is the jarring example. And then to kind of switch gears and say, you know what, we're gonna team up with them. And obviously, it comes down to money. But what was sort of the reaction from, for example, like Ron Price, chief operating officer of the PGA Tour? What was sort of his reaction to the idea of, we're not just talking about golf, we are now setting a precedent that any other sport owned by the United States can just be bought out by another country and controlled by another country?
Well, first, to respond to your point, which is really, really important, you know, Jay Monahan and Ron Price were among the most vehement critics of the Saudis.
Correct.
They said that they would resist being taken over. They supported players. Obviously, they requested players to stand with them and reject the huge amounts of money, literally $700 million for Tiger Woods, that the LIV Golf Saudi operation was offering them. And they sat across the table from me and Cromwell a year ago and asked me to support them, which I did. They asked the 9/11 families to support them. They asked their players to support them, all because the Saudis were such evil and detrimental potential involved in this game. And, of course, many stood by them. And then, in an instant, seemingly, they reversed themselves. And that's where we are now. But their explanation was, well, we had no choice. We were between a rock and a hard place.
What does that really mean, though? Like
when all this money.
Okay. So I was going to say, like, when they were sitting in there, I mean, was there any kind of solution that could have been gained from this? Because, like we mentioned, money obviously is what it comes down to. You're going to lose a bunch of really great players who are now representing LIV Golf. And the PGA can't compete with that. So like, what is sort of a solution then? Like, what was sort of, I guess, discussed in that three-hour hearing?
The point I made to them was they did have choices, and they do have choices. There are other sources of money. The Saudis aren't the only ones in the world who are potential investors in LIV Golf. And as I told them, point blank, they were winning this litigation. They were sued by LIV Golf, the Saudi operation, but they were on top. They were ahead. They had won many of the motions in court, and yet they decided to cave and sell out. And the point I made to them was Saudis have a lot of money, no question, but there are other sources of capital investment that they could have used. And even now, very importantly, even now, they could go to Wall Street, to equity investors, to golfers who have money to stay alive as an independent American institution. And they said to them, they ought to stand up for America. Their players stood up for them. Their athletes are on their side. And they decided to capitulate without even consulting, not a hint, with their athletes, their board members, their sponsors, their charities, or members of Congress like myself who stood with them. And I will continue to support the PGA Tour as an independent, iconic American institution because it's more than the game of golf that's at stake. It's other institutions in America that could be taken over by this public investment fund, an instrument of the Saudi monarchy to burnish its image around the world, to cleanse its reputation, and to avoid the smear of its human rights violation.
We're talking to Senator Richard Blumenthal, and earlier this week there was a committee hearing with the PGA Tour about the proposed deal between the PGA and LIV Golf last month. Again, it is proposed. It has not gone through yet. But Senator Blumenthal, my last question for you. Ron Price was quoted in a CNBC article, it seems, saying, I believe the PGA Tour will benefit the most from this proposed deal. Agreeing with Dunn, saying that if a deal were to get done, the tour would actually definitely stay intact and become more powerful than it has before. Do you agree with any of that?
It remains to be seen, Melissa, to be very blunt, because this agreement seems to give financial control, equity ownership to the Saudis. Now, we all know you can have plenty of people on a board of directors, but the entity or the person who owns an organization, who has the money invested, ultimately will call the shots. That's my fear. And that's why we're seeking to uncover exactly what the future of the PGA Tour will be, because we want it to be under the control of Americans, not Saudis. We want it to be used for the game of golf, not to sports wash the Saudi image around the world. And it's more than just golf that's at stake here. It is literally the potential investments that Saudis or other repressive regimes can make. Qatar is buying teams, so are other autocratic governments, and the Saudis are investing in Formula One and soccer and tennis. So we have to be on watch here because it's an important precedent that could be set. And he may think that the PGA Tour will be in control, but let's face it, money is what determined the outcome of this secret agreement. And again, Saudi money may determine who really controls the PGA Tour, and that is what I want to see to prevent. So right now we're just uncovering the facts. We're determining what our next steps will be. We're going to ask for Greg Norman and Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who is the head of the Public Investment Fund of the Saudis, to appear before the committee if we can work out scheduling. But most important, we're going to seek more documents. And we're hearing from athletes, fans, and others who have information because they are concerned as well.
Yeah, of course. And the only other thing, Senator Blumenthal, that dawned on me, I meant to ask you about this. I never understood that the PGA is a nonprofit. Now, I would imagine this is for, like, tax exemption reasons, because I think the NHL, I believe, is technically a not-for-profit. I don't believe the NBA is or the MLB. I don't think NFL is either, but you'd have to check my facts on that. But I never understood really, like, why even say a not-for-profit? Like, why not make that your first step of trying to pay, you know, players more? If you feel like there's such a threat with LIV Golf, maybe, I don't know if that would make a difference going from nonprofit to a for-profit organization. But was that something that was put on the table, or does that really not play a role in this?
They never considered any alternatives to the Saudi sellout. And your point is extremely well taken. The PGA Tour is a nonprofit. Its revenues every year are more than $1 billion. A lot of it goes to the athletes, but some of it goes to charities, and we want to know where the rest of it goes. And the important point here is that they have billions of dollars in assets, including the commercial and media rights, all kinds of real valuable assets that are going to go to this new entity controlled by the Saudis. In other words, our tax laws and taxpayers in this country permitted the PGA Tour to accumulate billions of dollars in assets without taxes, and now the results, the benefits, are going to go to the Saudis. I think
right.
There's something wrong with this picture.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's maybe I just sound crazy. Like, I'm listening to this logically out loud, and I don't even think there is a political thing here. It's just, this just sounds bizarre to me. Just very, very, I don't know. It just doesn't sit well. It doesn't taste good in my mouth. I don't know. It's very weird.
That's the feeling that a lot of Americans have, Melissa, and that's why we're seeking to uncover the facts through the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which I chair, and we're going to continue with this investigation. But we're also looking at others that involve waste of taxpayer money, for example, in the Medicare program. We're looking at ways that money may be wasted in other government programs and possible violations of law by private corporations. So this inquiry is not the only one. Some people have said, why are you focused only on the PGA Tour? Golf is golf. Who cares? But there's an important principle here, which is preserving a really iconic American institution. Mm-hmm. And there's also the tax implications that have cost Americans, or could cost them, billions of dollars in money that's going to the Saudis.
Yeah. Senator Blumenthal, I thank you for the time to talk about this. Please keep digging into it, and we'll keep discussing it here on the show. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you. We got word of something very, very exciting right here in the city of Milford. A new initiative was launched by the Milford Food Bank to help homebound people in need of assistance. The Milford Food Bank received a community development block grant for the purchase of a vehicle as part of the expansion in services. And joining me this morning are two lovely ladies who can talk a little bit more about this and the need here in Milford and what this means for them. We have Megan Brooks here, who is the Milford
Food Bank Coordinator, as well as Lenora Rodriguez, who is the Executive Director of the Milford Senior Center. Ladies, welcome both of you to the studio. I'm so glad you could be here. How are you?
Great.
Pretty well. Happy to be here.
I'm so glad that you're both here. So first of all, actually, Lenora, I'm going to start with you. Tell us from your professional standpoint, you know, Milford seniors, sort of what is the vibe here in Milford and some of the needs that seniors have currently?
Sure. So when it comes to a lot of our older adults here in Milford, besides wanting to get out, socialize with others, really the need for individuals is for nutrition. Yes, people do have food, which is good, but we want to make sure that they have the access to food all the time. We also want to make sure that overall their biopsychosocial needs are being met. If every person that comes in with a special need, whether it's friendship, whether it's just to get out of the house, whether it's to engage in fitness and exercise. That's what our center is really about, is really to get the whole person out and get them involved with life.
How have you seen a change in the seniors, especially since COVID and, you know, senior centers not being able to do what they usually would in 2020, and then trying to kind of rebuild and sort of reconnect them out of their homes and out in the community? How has it been the last couple of years sort of recovering from COVID?
Well, you know, we thought we would have a slow start, but to be honest, once we were able to kind of have access to vaccines, a lot of our older adults were just able to come back out, and they came full speed ahead. They wanted to get right back into whatever activity and social engagement that they had before. So whereas we thought it's going to be kind of slow, nope, not at all. They're just teaming to get back in and just start activities again and meet with friends and just have a good time. So a lot of us in the, you know, senior center world of folks who assist older adults through these type of programs and centers, we see it as an opportunity to really focus on what new things we can provide to them and where are the gaps. Mm. Because we did a lot to keep folks connected during the COVID period. And now we're just saying, what else can we do for you? What else is there that we're lacking and blind spots that we haven't really, you know, cleared up yet?
Mm, that's such a great point. And actually, that's a great intro into you, Megan Brooks, who, again, is with the Milford Food Bank Coordinator. Tell us about this new mobile food van.
The food bank van is actually really kind of cool because it allows us to be more cognitive to our community's diverse needs. It allows us to deliver food to the homebound individuals who might not otherwise have access to the pantry. And it is very important for us to provide access to food because we believe that food is a right, not a privilege. And just because somebody might have some form of mobility issues or a surgery that left them homebound doesn't mean that they should go without food.
Oh, that's so true. Now, I'm curious, it could be a ballpark, not to put you on the spot, but how many seniors have been able to now get access to your food because of this van service?
On average, we usually have like just under 100. I think June's report said about 92.
Wow. I did not expect it to be that high. I have to be honest. I thought you were going to say like a couple dozen. Wow.
No, unfortunately, in the community, we do have some older members, older adults who struggle with food insecurity.
Wow. That's incredible. So how does that work? So you've got 90 plus people who rely on your services. It's one van. How are you making all those deliveries within a week? Or how does that work?
So a person can call in if... they can call into the food bank and we can assess their needs over the phone with an intake form. We ask the name, their address, their phone number, how many people are in their household, and then we ask the duration of their disability to see if it's going to be a temporary or a permanent situation. So like if somebody has a surgery and they only need deliveries for 3 months, we'll give them the 3-month delivery service, but then we'll reassess at the end, and if they need an extension, we can add that on. What we do is we bag the food for them and weigh it. So there's an allotted amount of food each month for a person. One person gets 30 pounds of food, two people gets 40, and then it goes up into 5-pound increments until 60 pounds max for a family of six or more.
Wow.
So what we do is they tell us the kinds of food that they want, and if we have it, we bag it, and then we deliver it to the location that they give us.
That's amazing. All right, we are chatting today with Megan Brooks, who is the Milford Food Bank Coordinator, as well as Lenora Rodriguez. We were just talking about the need that Milford seniors and just the surrounding community, what we have found, and some really great news, a new initiative that's going on where there is now a mobile food van that is helping to get deliveries to seniors who are in need. And Megan just shared with us on the air that there's some 92 seniors, like just in the last month, that needed to use the delivery service. Tell us what that process looks like, Megan, first of all. Like, what does that look like when people come through the doors and say, hey, we need your help?
Yeah, so when a person calls for their appointment, what we do is sometimes we can do the intake over the phone if they want to, or they can fill it out when they come to the pantry. For their monthly appointment, they can come in and pick their own food. We use a process called client choice. There's a grocery cart inside the pantry so that a person can have the experience that, like they would at a grocery store. Mm. They can pick the food that they want, and then after their shopping is finished, myself and my volunteers will bag and weigh the food. And after that, we make their appointment for the following month. But if a person doesn't have like their calendar with them, they can always call back and make the appointment at another later date.
That seems pretty simple. Now, Lenora, are these strictly for Milford Senior Center seniors, or who qualifies for the access to the food?
So for qualifications, really just being a Connecticut resident.
Oh, really?
We don't require an individual to reside in Milford, and partly because we've had a number of families who have suddenly gone without an address. Mm. They're dealing with housing insecurity. They've become homeless. And so we have individuals who really are on foot. So we didn't want to limit just for folks who are right in Milford, although mm-hmm. those are our main clients really are from Milford. We have families in need, young families, families that include a grandma, a grandpa, and maybe a grandchild that's all together. So we didn't want to have it limited. And to be honest, the way our program runs, it should not be restricted just to the folks in one town. It needs to be open to the community because we are one community. We often look at ourselves as bordered of being just for Milford or of Orange or West Haven, but we just never know where we might land.
Where the need is.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. so if one of our communities is lacking, and we do, we have access to food, we would never tell a person, I'm sorry, you can't
right.
you can't have any
ever.
Food today. I'm sorry,
right.
you're going to have to go back and starve.
Yeah.
We would never do that. We would say, come on in. And we would also then help them find additional resources. We work with a lot of other agencies here in Milford. I have to say, Milford is one of the best set up towns when it comes to social services and access. We have Purple Pantry.
Human Services. Bethel, that's mm-hmm. a big one we use. We do, yeah. like, last year we did the Super Bowl of Caring mm-hmm. alongside Bethel at Mary Taylor.
Mm-hmm. So we have a number of resources here. So if a person comes to us and they get the allotment that Megan's able to provide, Megan can also provide them a list of all the other sources here
wow.
In town. And if there's needs somewhere else, connecting them to other services in other towns as well.
That's fantastic.
We want people to be able to not worry about, you know,
they have enough
food intake. There's so
right.
many things
from.
Going on when people
right.
come in. You
it's
know,
so true.
And
it's so true.
It's amazing. Just a little bit of joy you see when a person's like has that sense of release that they can eat. They can have something fresh.
Mm.
It's not just
sure.
shelf stabled items. We have fresh veggies and fruits and you just name it. Sometimes we get fun things like ice cream.
Somebody donated a bag of Jolly Ranchers.
That's amazing. There's nothing wrong with Jolly Ranchers. I'm gonna say that's. And my understanding when I was talking to you in the commercial break, Megan, was you would say some of the biggest needs are you were saying produce and meats.
Mm-hmm.
So if people wanted to donate, or maybe they want to volunteer, or maybe they want to sign up for your resources, where do they even start? Like, what would you suggest? A website or a phone number? Or what? Where do they go?
You can find us on the Milford Senior Center website. But if you call the food bank direct line, would you like me to provide that?
Sure, go okay. for it. That'd
it's,
be great.
The direct line for the food bank is 203-876-6000. 6142, or you can find us at the Milford Senior Center number, and that is 203-877-5131. You will be talking to myself as the coordinator, and we will schedule for a drop-off. You can randomly drop off, but we do prefer you call ahead so we know, especially if you're going to have perishable goods.
Okay. No, that's great to know. And when they call those numbers, they also can talk about volunteer opportunities as well.
Of course.
Because that would be really great, I'm sure. And so that's fantastic. So that you could call either of those numbers or, like you said, go to the Milford Senior Center's website. I want to thank you both for what you do and for coming in studio to talk about it. And I do hope that those resources continue to just thrive. Because like you both said, there is such a great need out there, and I'm glad that it is being recognized. I'm glad that we now have this mobile van, this unit that can get to people who can't get out. So thank you. Thank you for the great news today.
Yeah, if you see us driving around, it's a big red van. We call it the Flying Tomato, and it's got little food logos all over it, driving around in a red apple.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, thank you both for being here, and thank you for the work that you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Again, we have Megan Brooks, who is the Milford Food Bank Coordinator, as well as Lenora Rodriguez, Executive Director of the Milford Senior Center here on WICC. We have Tom Anderson back on the show, Director of Communications for the Connecticut Audubon Society, also Editor of Connecticut State of the Birds. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking. There was an article that actually one of our listeners forwarded to me, and I looked at it and I thought, this is really interesting. This is something that people who love their yards or their gardens may love to hear about this. People who are bird advocates, people who love the great outdoors of Connecticut. I feel like anyone who lives in Connecticut will love to hear about this. Planting trees that turn your yard into a bird oasis. What is this about, Tom?
Well, the idea is that a large portion of Connecticut's 3.5 million acres are private property, people's yards, and that all of those people could help reforest the state and make it better for climate change and also better for birds and other wildlife. And it really starts with something simple like planting a native tree.
How long on average, I was always curious about this, and it probably depends on the tree, but how long does it take for a tree to really grow and start making a difference? Or is it right away that birds can see a change just because you've planted something?
Yeah, but it's actually probably both. It's right away, and the older the tree gets, the better it is. You know, I was thinking about this morning, that exact question, because you know nobody wants to wait 80 years for an oak tree.
That's what I was thinking.
Even
20 years or something for an apple
exactly,
tree or whatever. Yeah.
So where we live, we got a birch sapling. It was 5 years ago, and it was maybe 5 feet tall, and planted it in our yard. And 5 years later, it's maybe 15 feet tall, and it's starting to spread over the lawn. So some trees grow fast. This was a river birch that we got at a town conservation board giveaway.
Oh, cool.
But other trees take longer, and you know, if you have a mix of fast-growing trees and slow-growing trees, that probably will do the trick. The other thing I want to say is that you don't necessarily have to plant a tree, because you know, if a nursery grows a sapling and transports it somewhere to be planted, that obviously has a carbon footprint. But if trees are regenerating right on your property, you know, if you have an oak putting out acorns and you have oak saplings, let them grow, see what happens. That's an excellent way to sort of reforest your area as well.
Now, I might be overthinking this, Tom, but I want to make sure that I'm asking, I think, kind of more, you know, I would say basic questions, because these might be very common. How do you know what trees are going to thrive in your yard? And what I mean by that is, like, do you have clearance for those trees? Like, how do you know how big they're going to get, or if you're going to have to transplant it, or that your yard is healthy enough for it? Is that a silly question? I was just curious.
No, it's not. But you might be asking the wrong guy. You probably need to ask the person who works at the local nursery or an arborist. I think Well, the plants that will do well in your yard are generally the plants that are the trees that already grow in Connecticut. And you can find lists of native plants for Connecticut. If you just Google it, you'll get an easy list. But it's things like sugar maple, red maple, white oak, red oak, the willows. Sleeping willow is weeping willow is a really good one, and birch trees. So all of those, you know, depending on the specific situation in your property, will do well. They're all adapted to all kinds of conditions. Willows and red maples like wetter areas, but red maples do fine in dry areas as well. The best thing to do is to ask at your nursery, and to make sure your nursery, ask them also about native plants and native trees, and look for a nursery that seems to have some expertise in that area, because native trees are much better for our area than ornamentals. They're adapted, they've evolved to go around here. And, you know, for people who love birds, the number of caterpillars and tiny worms that will live on an oak tree in early spring when birds are migrating is like 100 times more than will be on an ornamental tree. So native trees are not only will they grow better here, but they're better for the local wildlife.
That's amazing. Tom Anderson is here, who's with the Connecticut Audubon Society. And explain to us, if you don't mind, Tom, why are trees known as carbon sponges?
Yeah, well, trees, all plants take up carbon from the atmosphere and store it. So it's not in the atmosphere anymore. And trees are just better at that than, you know, for example, wildflowers, which are not bad either, by the way. An open native meadow is a great thing. But trees store carbon, and they get better at it as they get older. There was a study done at the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts that showed that they measured the amount of carbon being stored over 35 years, and they found that the older that a forest gets, the better it gets at storing carbon. So leaving old growth forests in place is a really good thing for mitigating climate change. And, you know, the other thing I want to say about that is that a few years ago, National Audubon did a study that showed that in Connecticut, there are a million and a half acres of forest, including in cities and suburbs, which if they're conserved and in some cases restored, they have the potential to store twice as much carbon per year as they do now.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible.
That's amazing. That
just by letting the forests grow and by restoring them, we could have such a big gain in our climate mitigation goals. You mentioned State of the Birds report before. One of the authors of that National Audubon study, Dr. Brooke Bateman, wrote an article about that for us in, I think, the 2021 State of the Birds. And she also did one of our Young Gifted and Wild About Birds Zoom presentations on it. So you can find both of those at ctaudubon.org if people are interested. Her study showed that if we in Connecticut, you know, the state, towns, individual landowners, including conservation organizations, work together to restore and conserve the state's forests, we can get almost one quarter of the way to the state's carbon reduction goal just by protecting forests, which is, when you consider all the money and effort that's going into electric vehicles and solar and wind power, to be able to get that much of a gain just by restoring and conserving forests is kind of incredible, particularly because it's also great for birds and wildlife.
We have Mr. Tom Anderson here, back with the Connecticut Audubon Society, and we're talking about the benefits of planting native trees and just in general having native plants in your yard to really help the bird population. And I wanted to really hone in on that, if you don't mind, Tom, and discuss really the benefits of trees and wanting to plant these native plants in our yards, why that benefits birds specifically and helps them with change, for example.
It benefits birds specifically because birds evolved in North America along with the native trees and shrubs. And because all these things are interconnected. The flowers and bugs that live on the native trees and shrubs have turned into the flowers and bugs that the native birds need to eat. And so, that's basically what an ecosystem is. All these things are linked together. And so native trees are simply better, provide more food and more habitat for native birds. We have, I forget if I've mentioned this in our previous calls, but we have a page on our website that we call Homegrown Habitat, where we, every month, we feature a new native plant, usually a shrub or a tree.
Oh, neat. No, you've never told me about that. That's cool.
Yeah, so let me mention it now then.
There you go, right?
Homegrown Habitat. You'll find it right on our homepage, ctaudubon.org. And it's written by a member of our board of directors, Sarah Middleier, who is a landscape planner. And she picks as I said, native tree or shrub every month. Over the month, she's written about the most recent was trumpet honeysuckle, which is a beautiful sort of orangish honeysuckle that hummingbirds love. Chokeberry, serviceberry, which some people also know as shadbush, which blooms beautiful white flowers in the spring. Pussy willows, which bloom in the early spring and are just unbelievable for birds. So anyway, you can check out Homegrown Habitat on our website and see what she's written. We just started it last, I think, September or October, and so there's about a dozen, maybe 10
I'm
or
looking
11 by
at
now.
It. This is really, really neat. Yeah, so you guys will be coming up on a year of doing this. So each month, something is mentioned, a different, like a witch hazel was mentioned in November, winterberry in December.
Yeah.
But that's really neat, and it has a description of exactly what it is and how it is beneficial to, you know, whatever habitats are around there and animals that are directly impacted by it. This is very cool. And again, the website is CT Audubon, spelled out, ctaudubon.org. And it's literally right there on the homepage, because at first I was up in the task bar looking, but it's literally the big blue box says Homegrown Habitat, your guide to what to plant for birds. That's brilliant.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
There's a robin eating some cedar berries, which is why I picked that one, because it's a good example of, you know, a native bird thriving on a native plant.
That is so cool.
Yeah, those little essays, by the way, which are short, also give guides for where to plant and how to plant on your property. So it's both, you know, sort of ecological information and gardening information.
Now, Tom, is there a specific time of year that people should start planting, or is it okay that it's the middle of July and people are inspired after hearing this conversation? I want to go out and get a tree and plant it in my yard. Is it okay to do that now, or are there certain seasons that we really should be targeting?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to defer again, or rather deflect again, because I'm not much of a gardener and hardly an expert. Certain things you want to plant at certain times of the year, but somebody at a nursery is much better to answer that question than me. Sorry.
That's okay. No, I appreciate the honesty. So that's what you should do. If you have a nursery nearby, a garden center, or you have a plant enthusiast, maybe ask them. Landscapers might be able to help you as well. But in the meantime, if you want to see more of the homegrown habitats that are recommended and you want to learn a little bit more and even talk to the folks over at the Audubon Society, you could do that by starting with their website, ctaudubon.org. And again, it's CT spelled out audubon.org. And Tom Anderson, I thank you so much for always coming on. We love our birds. We love our habitats. We love being in our backyards in Connecticut. And I just think this is a feature that so many people enjoy hearing about and hearing from the Connecticut Audubon Society. So thank you for always making yourself available.
You're welcome. It's fun to do it, and call me again.
I will. Oh, don't you worry. With the birds and the trees and all that, that's not going anywhere anytime soon. So I will definitely be giving you a buzz again really soon. That's Tom Anderson, Director of Communications for the Connecticut Audubon Society, also editor of Connecticut State of the Birds, right here on WICC.